I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is a special word-of-mouth holiday edition from New Hampshire Public Radio. Today, we'll hear about the astonishingly progressive origins of Monopoly and get a few tips for winning the game, which may well land under plenty of Christmas trees. We'll also hear about a new push to check out the antlers and redesign the après-ski chalet and try to get to the bottom of a persistent pop culture debate. Is Die Hard a Christmas movie? Plus, a word-of-mouth holiday classic. How would today's busy newspaper editors answer little Virginia's question? Is there a Santa Claus? But we begin with the science of giving.
Ralphie, what would you like for Christmas?
Horrified. I heard myself blurted out.
I want an official Red Ryder Carbon Action 2-inch Owens Ball Arrow.
No. Shoot your eye out.
The holiday classic A Christmas Story, little Ralphie wants nothing more than a Red Ryder BB gun. And spoiler alert, he gets one come Christmas morning. Would he have been just as happy with a lovingly hand-knit sweater? A number of recently published psychological studies on gifting could provide some guidance. Sumati Reddy is health columnist for The Wall Street Journal, and she looked into those studies and is with us to get inside the heads of gift givers and receivers. Sumati, great to have you with us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
People spend so much time agonizing over the perfect gift. Does that thoughtfulness pay off?
Essentially, no. I mean, we'd love to think that it does, but it actually does not.
Meaning what? People aren't happy even if you put a lot of time and energy into the gift?
No, I don't think that's it. I mean, I think it's that the benefit really goes to the person who's giving the gift. You, when you're shopping for someone and thinking about them and their personality and what they would like, you start feeling closer to that person. But the person that you're giving the gift to doesn't necessarily feel closer to you.
For the receiver, it is actually the gift, not the thought that counts.
Exactly. There's a couple of studies that look at this. There is one time when the thought does count, and that's basically when you're a friend giving another friend a gift that they do not like, then they might factor in the thought of the gift.
What's the disconnect here? I mean, why do gift buyers then get it wrong?
You know, that's an interesting question. A number of studies found that there's just this difference between givers and receivers, which is particularly interesting because we're all givers and receivers. You know, these are roles we shift into sometimes multiple times in a day, and yet there's still this disconnect. People still can't get it right.
How should we improve upon that? Any advice from the studies?
They basically say that you should get people what they want, whether that means asking them or picking up cues. When you're watching a commercial and your wife says, oh, that's a great dress, I'd love to have that dress, you know, then you get that instead of something that you think that they might like.
Is getting the wrong gift correlated to how much money is spent on gifts? I mean, there are plenty of things I would love to buy for people, but I just can't afford.
You know, there's a really interesting study on that a couple of years ago. The study's actually called Money Can't Buy Love, and it's in the Journal of Experimental Social Psychology. It looked at engagement rings and price, and it found that the more expensive rings didn't necessarily lead to a greater appreciation. I think everyone out there assumes that the more money you spend, the more it's going to be appreciated.
And you also cite, what is it, in Scrooge-onomics, that the receiver values a gift at 15 to 20% less than the actual cost.
Yeah, I mean, there's this interesting economic research done by a guy named Joel Waldfogel at the University of Minnesota. And according to his research, you know, if I buy you a $100 gift, you're going to value it 15 to 20% less than $100. Whereas if you bought yourself a $100 item, you'd value it $100.
Very fascinating. How about regifting? It used to be considered cheap or tossed off. Is that still true in our new economic era?
Well, that's, you know, coined by Seinfeld, but there's been a number of surveys. American Express did one that found that, you know, it's actually becoming more accepted. And then there was a study in psychological science this year which found that gift givers don't really care about regifting. They don't mind if you're going to regift their gift, but the receivers think the giver's going to mind.
The fatal error that I've heard of, regifting the gift to the person who actually gave it to you.
Yes, that does happen on occasion.
Well, it is a tremendous season of anxiety for so many people trying to find the right thing. Any takeaways from these psychological studies?
Yeah, I mean, I think people should just really not stress as much. Maybe try to ask them indirectly what they want or what they're looking for. And, you know, money might not matter as much as you think. The perfect gift or dreaming up the sort of most thoughtful gift for your wife might not be as important as you think. I would really just ask people indirectly, well, what do you want?
Okay, Sumati, what do you want?
What do I want? I want an iPad. That's what I want.
You know, you and
my
me both.
I'm listening right now.
Make sure he hears this. I want to thank you for your time and that little glimpse in.
Thanks so much.
Snow falls on the cars.
Sumati Reddy writes for the Your Health section of the Wall Street Journal, where she ran down the latest science of giving. There's a link to read the article on our Facebook page. And while you're there, share your giving or regifting tips.
What do you want? What do you want? What do you want me to give you? What do you want me to give you? Hey, did you wish it was a holiday?
Once Christmas vacation kicks off, skiers will flock to the slopes, assuming there's enough snow to make the trip worthwhile. Last year's dismal lack of powder made clear that even ample artificial snow does not have the allure of fresh powder. Out west, where powder is still plentiful, comes a transformation in après-ski architecture. The rustic loggy look and mounted antlers are being upgraded to sleek, modern alternatives. Taylor Quimby has the story.
Ski and snowboard enthusiasts, like many athletes, are constantly obsessing over new technology, whatever it takes to ski faster, safer, and look better on the slopes. Take it from Tim Farmer, owner of S&W Sports in Concord, who knows all about the latest alpine gear.
Shape skis, Magna Traction, Gore-Tex, Capaline baseware, GoPro camera. When you buy a new helmet, they come with wireless. So you can run.
But at the bottom of the mountain, the look and feel of alpine culture has remained surprisingly traditional. For resort buildings and vacation homes, cozy A-frames with steeply pitched gabled roofs and wide stone fireplaces have long been the standard. Margaret Supley Smith is an art historian at Wake Forest University and author of the forthcoming book, American Ski Resort: Architecture, Style, and Experience.
In the early years, an A-frame or a chalet just seemed to make sense in snow country. They were cheap, they were small, they were easy.
And of course, the gabled roofs kept snow from piling up and caving in the house. Now, 3D modeling and other advances in architecture have put new designs on equal footing with the traditional A-frame. Alyssa Abkowitz is a reporter for the Wall Street Journal.
They can be designed in ways where it melts off the side. And in some cases, particularly for using a metal roof with it, people encourage snow to stay on it because it acts as an insulator for the home.
Abkowitz wrote about the rise of contemporary structures in ski country. She says living habits are a factor, too.
With telecommuting being so popular these days, a lot of people are using their ski homes not just as a vacation home, but maybe, you know, living out there longer.
So instead of roughing it for a few weekends a year, vacationers might spend 2-3 months in Aspen, British Columbia, or in Europe. Again, here's Professor Margaret Supley Smith.
In the early days with, say, a Swiss chalet or an A-frame, having a second home at a ski resort was sort of like having an outboard motor boat. It was a small, playful thing where you didn't expect to have the same amenities that you would at home.
Now, multi-million dollar vacation homes going up in Colorado, Utah, and the French Alps are trading wood beams for steel ones and pine floors and walls for polished concrete and glass. Also on the chopping block is the traditional alpine decor that's defined the lodge look for centuries. Vacationers want a living space that doesn't feel tacky in June or July. So that means no more antler chandeliers, bearskin rugs, and Navajo blankets. Not everybody is sold on the death of the chalet-style ski house, though. Sherry Thurston is a broker with Sunday River Realty in Maine.
You know, it's like if you go to the Caribbean, I guess we'd want a pink house with seashells and turquoise. So it's part of the whole feel.
She says she likes the new contemporary styles that are popping up out west, but says the trend has been slow in migrating to New England.
There's one at the Peak, which is our premier subdivision at Sunday River, and it's the house everyone talks about. Oh, you know, the contemporary one.
Despite the intrigue, Thurston says builders in her region are continuing to point clients towards the classic alpine look. Margaret Supley Smith has a couple theories about why we Yankees are slow to catch on.
In the West, it's all new that these are purpose-built ski resorts where there wasn't a town. And in New England, they're adjacent to a town. So you've got Stowe connected, or you've got Waterville Valley, or you've got North Conway. So they're going to be a little bit more circumspect, and I think it also is a New England way not to be too grandiloquent.
And you can't underestimate the influence of alpine aesthetic on popular culture, which extends beyond the shadows of the Green, White, and Rocky Mountains. As part of its 2012 fall line, Ralph Lauren introduced the Alpine Lodge Collection, replete with heavy wood furniture, Native American patchwork design, and, of course, a stag antler candelabra and punch bowl. Alyssa Abkowitz admits it's too early to tell whether the contemporary look will have the same staying power as the Swiss chalet.
the Alpine look has been around for 200 plus years, a lot of people would argue that it's not going anywhere and that people still want that look when they go to the mountains. So it's definitely a risk, and frankly, it's too early to tell whether the resale value of these homes will be as popular as Alpine homes. But right now, they are selling.
For Word of Mouth, I'm Taylor Quimby.
And we'd love to hear your thoughts, or of course your yodeling skills. Where does the traditional feel of a slope-side A-frame stack up for you? Would you trade the drafty lodge for the comforts of heated floors and gas-fueled fireplaces? Let us know on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio. The end of the smartphone era is coming. That's a headline we recently spotted on businessinsider.com. A bit of a wet blanket for holiday marketing campaigns for the Samsung Galaxy, the iPhone 5, and a new generation of Windows phones. Are rumors of the demise of the smartphone being greatly exaggerated? We called on computer scientist and Word of Mouth explainer of all things Wired, Rob Fleischman. He can perhaps help us decide whether to return that iPhone we thought would make such an impressive Christmas gift. Rob, the end of smartphones? How can this possibly be?
Well, maybe we're looking at the dawn of wearable computers. Look at today. We have all these smartphones. They're getting closer and closer to our faces. They're all blinged up with fashion. You know, you can buy different covers. So the transition to a wearable computer, maybe a fancy set of shades, is not a hard leap. And the technology's gotten so small that, you know, most of the computing can fit behind your ear. They're GPS enabled. They'll have video. It's going to be wonderful. I mean, the Google Glass demo videos, which you can see online, are, you know, they're somewhat compelling.
We have been seeing sneak peeks of these little Google Glass videos. But what is the difference between what Microsoft is working on and the Google Glasses?
The distinguishing qualities between them are small, but they could be significant. Google's Glass project is mostly about a monitor, you know, a small computer screen kind of in the upper left corner of your eye. So you'll look around at the world normally, but when you peek in the upper left, it's kind of like having a video screen up there. People like Microsoft and, by conjecture, I think Apple, are really looking at what you call augmented reality, more like the heads-up displays fighter pilots see. Mm-hmm. So what I mean by that is they overlay the world with graphics. So I'll be looking at you, and it might, you know, put your name over your head so I remember that your name's Virginia Prescott. But there's other interesting things. For example, there's obvious uses for people in law enforcement, police, being able to record everything they see. We already have that for law enforcement in cars, but imagine if the officers are all wearing it. That would be really advantageous.
Okay, so that's sort of in the future, it looks
sure.
like. Just in time for Christmas, Apple has come out with the iPad mini. One of my colleagues, actually, who's going to remain anonymous for obvious gifty reasons, has a couple in a desk drawer. Looks exactly like an iPad, but smaller. I mean, we all sit around and said, oh, it's so cute. How is it innovative?
Well, I have a bold opinion on this one. I think that the mini...
You? Bold opinion
well,
on
yeah,
it?
I always have bold opinion. My take is the mini is really the form factor of choice. The larger tablets are terrific for at home, at work, but for the people who are on the go, who are going back and forth to work or commuting or on a plane, the mini size, those 7-inch things, and whether it's the iPad mini, a Kindle device or a Nook device, I think that's the form factor choice for the future. Mm-hmm. It's big enough, much bigger than a phone, but small enough that you can put it in a large pocket or a purse or, you know, a backpack.
Wondering if you've got some big picks for gadgets for gift giving.
This season, in terms of technology, there's two ways to go. It's the gaming platforms, you know, whether you're talking about the Wii U from Nintendo.
Right, or completely wireless.
Completely wireless. Wonderful device, really innovative. I'm really going to be excited to see what comes down the pipeline there. Or the tablet space. I mean, those are the go-to gifts, I think. And there's a lot of choices. It's a great time to be a consumer in these spaces. Great pricing from budget all the way up to high end.
Okay. Any Rob Fleischman particularly cravings for Christmas?
You know, I'd like a new pair of slippers.
Rob Fleischman is a computer scientist and chief technology officer at Zero Coal and our favorite explainer of all things slipper-like. Rob, again, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, Virginia. Always great to be here.
Bah humbug, no, that's too strong, 'cause it is my favorite holiday. But all this year's been a busy blur. Don't think I have the energy to add to my already...
Coming up, grab your race car or shoe. We're going to learn about the vehemently anti-capitalist origins of the world's most popular board game, Monopoly. So we'll be back with Rich Uncle Pennybags and all the rest. Word of mouth continues. Never the time. Most of 81 pass along those lines. So deck those halls, trim those trees, raise up cups of Christmas cheer. I just need to catch my breath. Christmas by myself this year.
I think it's wrong that only one company makes the game Monopoly.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
24-hour banking? I don't have time for that.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Plan on giving someone the game of Monopoly this holiday? The official website for the classic board game boasts that it's sold more than 275 million games worldwide. It's been released in 43 languages, in Braille, and in chocolate, and was used for secret communications by the Brits during World War II. Hasbro history has it that Monopoly was invented in 1933 by Charles Darrow, an unemployed radiator repairman from Philly. But that American success story masks Monopoly's more remarkable origins. Christopher Ketchum wrote for Harper's about the history of the world's most popular, though hardly populist, board game. Hi, Christopher.
Hey there.
Decades before Parker Brothers patented Monopoly back in 1935, it was called something like the Landlord's Game. Now, tell us, who created it and where the idea came from?
The Landlord's Game was the invention of an actress and sometime cross-dresser named Lizzie McGee, who stage acted in Baltimore and Washington. She wanted to create a game that taught that being a landlord was evil because landlords controlled land, and in doing so they could basically send renters into poverty by constantly raising rents. Now, McGee was actually she was a follower of a 19th century economist and philosopher named Henry George, who taught that land ownership in America especially had resulted in monopoly power over an inelastic commodity, that is land. Inelastic because as demand increases, you cannot increase supply.
Mm-hmm.
So Lizzie McGee wanted to give to the world a board game that would teach Henry George's philosophy and would show that, all right, we cannot allow the few to monopolize land, or else the rest of us will all be in the poorhouse.
It's just so ironic that this becomes a game about, you know, celebrating the monopolist, celebrating the one who squeezes the most money out of everybody else.
Yeah, it's kind of ridiculous. But a perfect example of how, you know, modern capitalism works. I mean, the game is invented by Lizzie McGee. It's embellished, and the rules are advanced by all sorts of different players throughout the years. A professor at the Wharton School of Finance, college players all throughout the East Coast, the major Ivies, the Quakers, or groups of Quakers in the Northeast, and especially in Atlantic City, take to it, and they, again, start advancing its rules. And so you have this sort of communal process, this communal labor that goes into the creation of what becomes Monopoly. So the game has moved virally throughout cities and colleges, and it ends up in Atlantic City in the beginning of the Depression. And there it is played by two brothers, the Rayfords, and the Rayford brothers share it with the putative inventor, Charles Darrow. And Charles Darrow then goes on to commit fraud. He copies down the rules, he copies down the board and the chance cards, the community chess cards, et cetera, and then he goes on to claim that he was the sole inventor. He goes to Parker Brothers, and Parker Brothers, whose executives know about the Monopoly prehistory, they know that Charles Darrow is not the inventor, they know about this long history of communal labor, but they join him in the fraud and approach the U.S. Patent Office to get a fraudulent patent. As a result of that fraudulent patent, Monopoly, which theretofore had been a public domain game played by anyone, freely exchanged, like chess or checkers or dominoes, now becomes a privatized commodity for sale in the marketplace, monopolized by a single corporation.
Why do you think the new version took off so well? I mean, it was not just played by radicals and socialists.
Probably because it plays to our worst, basest, acquisitive instincts. I mean, a lot of the people I spoke to who, the Monopoly historians who had played the original Landlord's game, found it rather boring because, you know, everyone was cooperating and you know, everyone's making nice and the idea was creating a utopian society. But I guess utopian societies aren't much fun, at least in board game form.
We're speaking with freelance writer and Counterpunch columnist Christopher Ketchum. He wrote a fascinating history of, let's say, the anti-capitalist origins of the board game Monopoly for Harper's Magazine. Well, I have to say, Christopher, that's not what happens in my family. You know, when I was growing up, I think it did, I guess, appeal to some unattractive, very competitive part of human nature. But nobody ends up feeling good walking away. You've either stomped on somebody or you're in the poorhouse. It doesn't really make people feel good.
Oh, I don't know about that. I mean, in my family, we would compete. I loved competing. I was cheating all the time.
I always cheated, too. That's why I don't like about the electronic version. You can't cheat.
That was the whole heart of Monopoly for me as a kid. It was cheating. Everything was about cheating, which, of course, is perfectly reflects what capitalism is today in America. Competing, no, not really competing, but competing in such a way that you're stabbing competitors in the back.
Okay, so Christopher, what does this mean? That you are a sort of secret cutthroat capitalist somewhere underneath there? That's part of your human nature?
No, I think what happened is, as my part of my training as a child in playing this game was toward being a cutthroat capitalist, but I have since struggled against the malediction.
Well, as part of the research for the story, you spent a day at the annual corporate Monopoly tournament in Pittsburgh and got to witness a variety of different strategies. Did you get any sense that the players there were using some sort of strategy that the rest of us aren't aware of? Is there a key to winning at Monopoly?
The only key to winning at Monopoly is to get monopolies. That's it. That's it. You know, the roll of the dice is basically the determining factor there is luck. And then I guess a certain amount of risk-taking in terms of your purchases, in terms of your ratio of available capital to the property that you're buying. But on the other hand, when you watch these tournaments, everybody buys every piece of property they always land on. And then they start trading. So I suppose it is constant acquisition coupled with the willingness to barter and trade. You know, you make judgments. You say, okay, if I trade this guy Park Place and he trades me Ventnor and Marvin Gardens, then we'll both have monopolies. How powerful is my monopoly compared to his monopoly, et cetera, et cetera. Among these players, I did find that they had read statistical accountings of exactly which properties are the most landed on. For example, the properties downboard from the jail are the most landed on statistically because you end up at the jail far more often than any other specific square because of the community chess cards, the chance cards, and the go-to-jail space.
I'm thinking that, you know, probably in Lizzie McGee's sort of version, you know, this is all about chance, obviously, but not about that early economic thinking of capitalism as unleashing creativity and innovation and creating competition and opening markets and expanding trade. What do you think Lizzie McGee would think of today's version of Monopoly, the one that has become so popular?
It's an abomination. I mean, she would just think this is a joke and the joke's on her. Obviously, the whole message of Monopoly has been inverted. The whole history of the game has been erased. And the process by which the game was formed, again, that communal labor that I referenced earlier, that too has been erased and replaced rather by this myth of the sole inventor, Charles Darrow, who, of course, became a multimillionaire as a result of Monopoly.
Well, Christopher Ketchum, it certainly is a fascinating read, and I want to thank you for joining us.
All right. Thank you.
Christopher Ketchum is a columnist with Counterpunch. His work has also appeared in GQ, Vanity Fair, and Harper's, where we found his fascinating history of Monopoly. There's a link to read it and to our breakdown of that story on our Facebook page, Word of Mouth Radio. We'd love to know if you agree with Christopher. Does Monopoly bring out the worst in people? Or is it a game that you look forward to playing at family gatherings? Maybe even a marathon on Christmas Day. Let us know what you think on Facebook or send us a tweet at Word of Mouth. And now for an underground holiday debate from the pop culture sphere. Is Die Hard a Christmas movie? May not be warm and fuzzy, but the Bruce Willis blockbuster has appealed to many as an alternative Christmas favorite since its release in 1988. That classification, however, has not gone unchallenged. Word of Mouth intern Bill Berry has a story.
To many, any best of action film list would ring hollow, with the exclusion of Die Hard.
Got invited to the Christmas party by mistake. Who knew?
Every year, though, as the holiday season approaches, Die Hard begins to fly under a different flag. Kevin Noonan of The Observer calls it a Christmas classic disguised as an action thriller, and he's not alone. Just listen to Die Hard fan Kevin Flynn.
What doesn't say Christmas like a terrorist plot foiled by Bruce Willis?
Now I have a machine gun.
Film analyst Garen Daly contributes a more academic theory.
It's been talked about ever since the film came out, because it takes a Christmas theme and turns it into an action, violent film. There are a lot of films that families use these days as traditional family films at Christmas time that would not necessarily be called Christmas films.
Garen submits that non-traditional Christmas films expose what family and Christmas is all about, though in a slightly twisted fashion. Die Hard, upon deconstruction, is an alternative tale about a family coming together.
Why don't we make it easy? I have a spare bedroom. Kids would love to have you at the house.
They would, huh?
I would, too.
Both Forbes and Empire magazine list Die Hard number one on their lists of top all-time Christmas films, with Forbes describing it as everything a Christmas movie should always be forever. But not everyone is on board. Sam Todd of the student paper Impact Nottingham refuses to lump Die Hard in with such Christmas classics as It's a Wonderful Life.
Look, Daddy, teacher says every time a bell rings, an angel gets his wings.
I think you have to make a distinction between a movie set at Christmas, like Die Hard, and a Christmas movie. A Christmas movie is so much more about the feeling and the atmosphere rather than its setting.
Sam defines Die Hard as a cold film, polar opposite in feeling than the traditional Christmas films of yore.
It could be a victim of the sort of 80s aesthetic. The Nakatomi Plaza, it's bare and it's unfinished. It's not a warm Christmas setting, and as well as that, you also have poor Al and Argyle, who are stuck working on Christmas Eve.
Come out to the coast, we'll get together, have a few laughs.
Leon Thomas of GuyWithTheGlasses.com presents an objective methodology, breaking the Christmas movie definition down to five questions.
1. Does it take place around Christmas? 2. Do we learn something about the Christmas spirit? 3. Are there any visual or audio references to Christmas, like seeing elves or hearing jingle bells? 4. Is the Christmas element absolutely essential to the plot? And 5. Do people watch this movie around Christmas?
Leon says the results come out to a tie, though he finds tie-breaking wisdom in a familiar tune.
And if Winter Wonderland can be a Christmas song with no Christmas lyrics, then Die Hard is without a doubt a Christmas movie, even though it is mainly about non-Christmas themes and events.
While movie bloggers and critics might not totally agree, what might matter most is what the fans think. When the holidays come around, do you find yourself surrounded by family, fires, feasts, and a hearty serving of Die Hard?
It's Christmas, Theo. It's the time of miracles, so be of good cheer.
For superfans like Kevin Flynn, the answer is simple.
As Argyle said, if this is how they spend Christmas, I gotta be here for New Year.
For Word of Mouth, I'm Bill Barry.
Okay then, how about you? Is Die Hard Christmassy enough for your holiday playlist? You can join the debate. It's already in progress on our Facebook page, Word of Mouth Radio. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
For word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word,
word
of mouth.
Mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. As the weather turns and the holidays draw near, my mind turns to chocolate. A friend of mine told me that the drinking chocolate at Dancing Lion in Manchester, New Hampshire, is beyond compare. So I paid a visit, which pretty much sounded like this.
Wow. That is delicious.
Oh, my God.
Wowie.
Oh, my God.
Wow.
Yes, the confections handmade by chocolatier Richard Tango, Lowy, and his staff are superb. But the tiny storefront's autumnal color scheme and display of exquisitely crafted bonbons and truffles and bars embrace all the senses.
It smells like Paris. I love to hear
it. Richard began his career as a physicist at the Space Park campus in Redondo Beach, California. The origins of a chocolatier, however, started with melting a bag of chocolate chips to less than satisfying result. The failure led him to a block of Valrhona chocolate and a decade of perfecting his craft. He eventually trained at the prestigious Valrhona School in France and opened up the shop in Manchester a year ago.
Our byline is chocolate is art, and my approach to art is it's temporary. You see it, you put it in your mouth, you taste it, and then it's gone. And I think you do that with any art. And I think we just take that to an extreme.
As a person raised eating Hershey bars who now fancies herself a teeny bit chocolate snob, Richard was happy to educate me on the nuances of cacao.
This is 1 kilo I have of this, Ecuador 65%. You taste. Very floral, delicate.
Can you discern where a chocolate is from if you taste it?
Oh, absolutely, if it's good chocolate. There's definitely terroir, but they change even more than wine or coffee, which is why we make each of our recipes exactly one time. It's gone, because the cacao will be different next year. All the other ingredients will be different next year.
We sat down to sample the aforementioned drinking chocolate and a croissant at one of Dancing Lion's 4 small cafe tables. Today's mix is a blend of Vietnamese and Madagascar milk chocolate with a little local honey. It's made with water instead of milk, which Richard says blunts the taste buds, and served in rimless bowls that you cradle in your hands.
Wowie.
It's an experience. You can't drink chocolate from a bowl while thinking about anything else. It's completely mindful.
Richard's deep appreciation for high-quality ingredients comes through. By his description, Dancing Lion is part Juliette Binoche and Chocolat, whose confections are like prescriptions for her ailing customers.
What does it look like to you? Just say the first thing that comes into your mind.
A woman riding a wild horse? Silly answer.
Oh, no, there are no silly answers. The pepper triangle, that's for you.
I'll just say, I need something. And we know those customers, and we know by looking at them what they need. And we give it to them.
Mixed in is a bit of Gene Wilder's deranged and slightly evil Willy Wonka, wildly imaginative, like the mad scientist focused on his creation.
Oh, Augustus, please, don't do that. My chocolate must never be touched by human hand.
Chocolate is a 6-phase polymorphic crystal. A fair amount of a caffeine variant called theobromine. Emulsifying the butter in the mixer for a certain amount of time. You know, what's the right proportion of water? Let's do the experiment and let's see. We all have our lab notebooks. Everybody keeps notes on stuff.
My beautiful chocolate!
Even a scientist is at the mercy of the whims of the elusive soul and the fluctuating market for chocolate.
We're tied into world politics. We can't help it. It's the nature of cacao. It's tough. It's a crop that grows in regions that tend to be not good regions politically or militarily or economically. It's subsistence. If a guerrilla group comes in to a place where there's a plantation and the family that grows that cacao is forced to leave, it'll be 5 years before they can grow cacao again. If they lose that crop, they're gone for a while. And that's very hard. So a lot of these small chocolate makers are really trying to use cacao to improve the local economies. I did a piece that was about Guatemalan history. Spanish came in, conquered, much more complex story than most people realize, and it was a bonbon, pure Guatemalan chocolate. We did some corn in it, and it was a disc, it was a coin. With a ganache on the inside, we finished it in gold with a few drops of red and some other sort of religious other symbolism on it. You may get it, you may not get it, but it's there, and it's what gives it I think it gives it spark.
It's a bittersweet story that you won't find in a box of Russell Stovers, and customers are eating it up. Richard and his staff, who I might add are not Oompa Loompas, ship chocolates from South Africa to high-end restaurants in Portsmouth and Newburyport, and he's planning to open a shop in Paris and later Barcelona. But if you're not traveling overseas anytime soon, there is plenty to experience on Elm Street in Manchester. Time magazine released its annual list of the 9 most Christmas-loving towns in America. The closest, Christmassiest town to us here at Word of Mouth is Woodstock, Vermont. We asked correspondent Sean Hurley to investigate the pinnacle of Woodstock's holiday events, the Wassail Weekend. Little did we know that Sean could have been a contender for the Grinchiest Guy Possible list.
So we were driving along toward Christmas in a rinky mix of slush and ice and half-baked snowflakes. It seemed to me that sand was falling too, if that's possible. My son smelled like peppermint sticks, my wife like a Christmas tree, and I smelled vaguely of prisoners because I was wearing my old sweater. Now maybe prisoners don't smell like my old sweater, but that's how I was feeling. Not too sunny, more Grinch than Santa, more early Scrooge than late. And yet, here we were, heading into the very heart of Christmas. The first thing we did when we got to Woodstock was not park for a long time. We shuffled along behind the other latecomers, hoping we wouldn't miss the great Wassail Parade, which I called Wassail, my wife called Wessel, and my son called Waffles. But we parked finally beside a dry riverbed somewhere near the moon, and dashed along until we crossed a covered bridge and found ourselves there, on Main Street in Woodstock, as close to the substance that Time magazine might call Christmassiness as you can get.
Silver Maple Farm of Cumberson, 10 of their ice.
The Wassail Parade is a horse parade, both medieval and Dickensian. No batons are twirled, no dancing clowns. It's a stately, dreamlike affair. The riders wear holiday costumes or period garb. There are lots of top hats and flowing capes and feathers. But despite this spectacle, I still wasn't feeling it, as this secret surveillance audio I obtained from myself reveals, as I snuck away to get coffee and left my recorder on.
I wouldn't touch you with a 39 and a half ago.
You're a mean one, Mr. Grinch. You really are a heel. You're as cuddly as a cactus. You're as charming as an eel, Mr. Grinch. You're a bad banana with a greasy black peel.
Well, I was a bad banana with a greasy black peel. My wife and son have been filled with this excelsior of Christmas spirit since before Thanksgiving, a kind of golden, glittery mood that had passed me by entirely. "Christmas is in here, son," the old-timer tells the jaded kid in every Christmas classic. Then he taps the kid right on the Christmas heart with his Christmas finger.
"Just remember, the true spirit of Christmas lies in your heart."
"Not in my heart, Tom Hanks, Santa Claus." We went along next to the church to listen to the a cappella singing group, The Ten. They sang beautifully, and to be fair, we did arrive a little late, and so I guess we stumbled upon the tropical medley section of the performance.
"Down in Jamaica, they got lots of pretty women. Steal the money and they'll break your heart."
This isn't very Christmassy.
I was trying my hardest, but it kept going on and on. While I didn't have a useful old-timer to jab me in the Christmas heart, the Wassail schedule showed that they were going to set fire to the Yule log and light the massive memory tree and sing Christmas carols on the green. Even the stoniest among us would have to soften. There was a little feedback problem until the old accordion player blasted the wicked circularity into oblivion. It wasn't the accordion player's fault. He was very good and jolly. The fire was vast and warm. The tree was triangular and tall and well lit. Everyone was smiling and crowding the fire and very Christmassy. But for some reason, that accordion was shooting rusty daggers directly into my head.
There's one thing I hate. All the noise.
It would have been right there if I'd been a green cartoon character and had a sled and lived on Mount Crumpet, that I would have tied some antlers to my left boot and headed down into Whoville to see some who's about a what that I hoped to not. Everyone singing, all pressed close, the fire bright, a deep-eyed yellow, the tree glowing with memories, the accordion bullets shooting into my head. And that's when it hit me. Woodstock was Whoville, and I was the Grinch. Look, some years you're sliding down the chimney. You're always merry and always bright. But some years you're racing down Mount Crumpet. If you're ever going to have your heart grow two sizes too big, you have to let it also be two sizes too small. But clarity is helpful. Knowing you're the Grinch, you can just relax. There's nothing you can do that will stop those who's from singing. The word of mouth, high atop Mount Crumpet, I'm Sean Hurley.
To see photos from Sean's Grinchy trip to Woodstock, go to wordofmouthradio.org. Yes, Virginia, there is a Santa Claus. I can't tell you how many times I've heard that in my lifetime. Still, the statement from a big city newspaper man to a little girl has endured for more than a century as an affirmation of Christmas spirit, the power of belief, and the seasonal thawing of cynicism. A few years ago, producer Avishai Artsy wondered how contemporary editorial writers would answer that question. Admittedly, he's a little more than 8 years old, but several still took his call.
In the summer of 1897, soon after her 8th birthday, Virginia O'Hanlon sent off a letter to the editor of the New York Sun. It read,
"Dear editor, I am 8 years old. Some of my little friends say there is no Santa Claus. Papa says if you see it in the sun, it's so. Please tell me the truth. Is there a Santa Claus?"
A few weeks later, a longtime writer at the Sun, Francis Farcella's Church, penned a response. It was published in the 7th place on the editorial page on September 21st, 1897. It began,
"Virginia, your little friends are wrong. They've been affected by the skepticism of a skeptical age. They do not believe except what they see. They think that nothing can
be..." The editorial was not an instant classic. The New York Sun grudgingly reprinted it 5 years after its publication. It was only in the early 1920s that the editorial began appearing without fail. It soon became a tradition for newspapers around the country to reprint the story on Christmas Day. W. Joseph Campbell teaches journalism at American University.
Very interesting to have read readers' comments over the years, and many of them found reassurance in this editorial, even in the dark days, arguably darker days, facing the country than today. At the cusp of World War II, for example, or in the depths of the Great Depression.
"Yes, Virginia, there is a Santa Claus. He exists as certainly as love and generosity and devotion exist. And you know that they abound and give to your life its highest beauty and joy."
Campbell says one reason the editorial has endured is its remarkable ability to tackle complex philosophical questions while still addressing an 8-year-old girl. There's also the nostalgia it inspires in adults and the romanticism not usually found in newspaper copy. Drew Klein edits the editorial page at the New Hampshire Union Leader.
And he brings in fairies, and he takes such a unique approach in connecting the unseen world, the world of fantasy and romance, to her regular life. And I just thought that was so beautiful. But I just don't think you could see anything like that today. I just think that connection with the romantic idealism of that era is just so far gone at this point.
Carolyn Lumsden edits the editorial page at the Hartford Courant. She says that while it might seem surprising that cynical journalists would love such a starry-eyed piece of writing,
they're also the biggest suckers, and they're the most sentimental people when you get to them, when you can get past the skepticism. This is the sort of thing they really fall for. When they really believe in something, they believe in it, you know, to the point of utter mushiness and sentimentality.
And she thinks they love it for another more practical reason.
Because it's a great example of something, you know, you're forced to write on deadline and it turns out a lot better than you expected it to.
The Union Leader's Drew Klein says journalists also yearn for a time when an 8-year-old girl would take stock in what a newspaper prints.
An 8-year-old girl would go to her parents' computer and Google Santa, real and see what comes up. Her letter begins with, you know, Papa told me that if it's in the sun, it's true. That sort of faith in journalism and in institutions, it just doesn't exist anymore.
Some editorial writers wonder whether a letter like Virginia's would even be answered today. Dan Haley edits the editorial page of the Denver Post.
Newspapers today were so trapped into doing what we've always done. And we have to stop that. We have to stop relying on the old way of doing things. Well, this, you know, we write editorials only about boring topics that are important and people want to hear them. It's like sort of forcing people to eat their vegetables.
Peter Canellos, editorial page editor of the Boston Globe, says journalists can learn from the piece about staying relevant.
I think that's a great moment in editorial writing, and it shows what we as newspapers should do and what can be a real linchpin of our survival and our redefinition of our mission going forward, and that is we should speak to the community in a way that reflects broad recognition of the community's values, of the challenges that are facing the community, and speak for people who don't have a voice.
Canellos says if he were asked to write a response today, he'd say we need more Santa Clauses and a greater feeling of brotherhood.
I'm not saying that would be better than the classic response. You know, my editorial would last 5 minutes. That editorial lasted 100 years.
Drew Klein at the Union Leader says he too grapples with how to answer the question, not just as an editorial writer, but also as a father.
I actually have a 7-year-old. We're wondering if this is the last year that he's going to believe in Santa. And that editorial has actually been an inspiration for me in thinking about how to deal with that question when he inevitably asks it.
Whether Santa Claus exists isn't really the point. The man who answered Virginia's question, Francis Church, wasn't talking about facts. He was talking about faith. And he was writing to all of us, not just Virginia. Hundreds of newspapers will reprint his editorial on Christmas Day, and they'll continue to as long as children still believe in Santa, and adults are nostalgic for a time when they did too.
No Santa Claus? Thank God. He lives and lives forever. 1,000 years from now, Virginia. Nay, 10 times 10,000 years from now. He will continue to make glad the heart of childhood.
You can read the original New York Sun editorial at wordofmouthradio.org. Special thanks to Cadence Solsky for providing the voice of Virginia O'Hanlon and to Sean Hurley for the voice of Francis Church. And thank you to Avishai Artsy for putting together a story that's become a word of mouth classic.
Is that you, Santa Claus?
Take it from me, Virginia. Even if not always or immediately apparent, there are plenty of things to make glad the heart. We do hope you find them this holiday. And on behalf of all of us here at Word of Mouth, thank you for the gift of your listening time, your ideas, your conversations. A merry, merry Christmas from Word of Mouth and NHPR.
Gifts I'm preparing for some Christmas sharing, but I pause because hang in my stocking, I can hear a knocking. Is that you, Santa Claus?
Sure. Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby Zach Nugent, Virginia Prescott, and senior producer Rebecca LaBoy. Ho, ho, ho. The views expressed on this program are not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. To read our blog or report someone for not being nice, go to wordofmouthradio.org. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.
My, oh me, my. Kindly will you reply? Is that you, Santa Claus?